lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse.
Robin, my eldest son, has spent a long time trying to change the world, and one of his efforts has been to take over the creation of a radio program called Unwelcome Guests, transmitted over the internet, where each week he makes a 2-hour recording which selects pieces, interviews, radio programs of alternative views, not the mainstream media by any means, where I have listened to Robin's propaganda, as I used to call it, but realise that he is on the right wavelength, and if he would got it right, and the rest of the world, and formerly me, would got it wrong.
You're listening to episode 750 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton, and that was my mum, who, towards the end of her life, became very encouraging and was a great support to me in my efforts to seek the truth and to broadcast it. This episode, Black is the New White, is an encouragement to try to question what we think we know by looking closely at the historical record. It's an ambitious effort to condense 19 years of audio and half a dozen years of research into the deep state into a single piece of audio. This is the show that I've been planning on making for years and never quite got round to. I thought, what would happen if, rather than follow the normal formula of having two or three insiders, whistleblowers, expert speakers speaking on their specialist subject, so rather than having a few speakers speaking for a longer period of time, what about if I reviewed the 1,500 odd hours of audio that we have so far in the show and selected the highlights, a couple of minutes from each show which best epitomize that show's message, and did so in a larger narrative, if I wove those few minutes of expertise that reflect years of study into a coherent narrative. So that's what I'm going to be trying to do. The subtitle, A Deep State Odyssey, from the JFK assassination to the Integrity Initiative, will give you an idea of where this is going. I am going to be focusing on new listeners, so if you've not heard any of the former episodes, I hope you will still be able to take a lot away from this show. In order to preserve the narrative, I have edited some of the clips from earlier episodes, and I won't be introducing each of the speakers carefully by name and telling you where the recording was made. Instead, I will be giving you a show number. So, if I say episode 87, then you can look that up at unwelcomeguest.net/87. And I'd encourage you, if any of this information strikes you as particularly interesting or worthy of further research, to download the full 2-hour show and give it a listen. This has been a voyage of discovery for me. I didn't know quite what this bigger picture was going to tell me until I was done making it. And what better way to start than with Lynn Gehry's explanation of the purposes of the show back in episode number 4.
This program is actually a class in learning to read between the lines of the lies our so-called leaders spout. By the end of this course, you will gain a different understanding about what is meant by defending democracy, tough on crime, war on drugs, economic empowerment zone, and free trade.
And that episode, The Sword and the Dollar, featured a speech by Michael Parenti. He went on to say that
the primary function of the national security state is to defeat anti-capitalist forces at home and abroad. or movements that try to introduce any economically redistributive politics, even within the existing capitalist framework, in any kind of fundamental reformist way.
Parenti giving one example there of what's going to be a recurrent theme, an official narrative given to the public for why an institution is there and what it's doing, and behind the scenes, a very different story. So Jim Douglas, for example, claims in episode 517 that
President Kennedy's greatest conflict was not with any communist enemy. It was with his own national security state.
I wouldn't be at all surprised, especially if you're new to the show, if some of the claims you hear, such as that one, strike you as very implausible, especially if you've read up official histories of these events. One of the repeated patterns we're going to see is not mistaken history, but deliberately deceptive history. How do you make black into the new white? You repeatedly tell people that black is white, and you do so not through a monotony of sources, but you give them an apparently wide diversity. So you have thousands and thousands of different TV channels and periodicals and gossip columns, and they appear to be in some kind of consensus. If you trace back the ownership, you find that these are more consolidated now than they ever have been. So they're not independent voices. They're also not independent from government announcements. And it's not necessary for the people who are working for these organizations to understand the deeper purposes. We know the newsreaders will read whatever they're told to read. They don't take responsibility for that truth or falsehood. And who actually takes responsibility? Well, we're going to hear. It's not against the law for news organizations to read fake news. They have a freedom of speech to say what they like, and it may be bad practice. We'll hear a legal case about that later on. The point I'm making is this is another very common pattern, a repeated set of lies that go from institution to institution. And where did they come from? Who cooked them up? Well, who are the super rich? We could name a few names, but compared to the politicians and newsreaders, the people that the camera is focusing on, they're really hiding in the shadows. And I don't want you to think that the main deception is through lies. That's just one means available. Another very powerful way of influencing people, as Orwell noted in 1984, is to have control of the language, to put forward deceptive concepts. We shall be getting on to that in due course too. Another key way that corporate media deceives people is by selective omissions. So if you're new to the show again, you may not have heard of Operation Gladio. This NATO operation started around 1945, nominally with the purpose of defending Western Europe against Soviet encroachment, and that may have been what was in the minds of the people who set it up. They may not have planned to set up an organization which would carry out bombings, assassinations, kidnappings against Western civilians or politicians. Here we meet another repeated pattern, that sort of organizational drift. We can have a group which is set up with one purpose, and over time, especially if it's in secret, it can evolve to the point at which it's actually counterproductive. So part of it may be busy fighting terrorism, part of it may be busy creating terrorism in order for it to fight. And lest I become too theoretical, let's hear from perhaps the world's most respected researcher into Operation Gladio. This is Daniela Ganza speaking about the Italian arm of that international network, which was organized through a Masonic lodge called Propaganda Due.
Propaganda Due was a network of people who were from the parliament, from the executive, who were leading industrialists, who were bankers, and who also were judges or police officers or military officers. And they all cooperated behind the scenes.
And one of the reasons why I chose Operation Gladio is not just because it's a key event in the formation of the supranational deep state, but also because it was so clearly exposed, was admitted at the highest levels in the Italian Parliament, so therefore it would have been very difficult for corporate media to maintain credibility if they had just kept silent about it. It was the subject of a 2.5-hour film that was broadcast on BBC Two. That was in 1992, if I remember correctly, and we adapted it for 4 episodes of the show. So if you're in any doubt at all about NATO-sponsored terrorism, I would encourage you to check the historical record on Operation Gladio. The official NATO position, they issued a denial saying, no, we don't know anything about this. And then later, I think it was the next day, it was very soon after, they said that that earlier denial was incorrect and left it hanging. Very ambiguous state. You might think that the supposed democracies of Western Europe, because people would want to know whether their tax bills were going partly to fund the assassination and terrorization of other citizens, people would want to know about this. Well, it has not been properly investigated. That illustrates another symptom that we're going to keep coming up against, which is a difference between theory and practice. So in theory, you have wonderful separation of powers and the system is self-correcting and you have a few bad apples here and there. Well, the system will take care of it. In practice, it's an open secret. Lobbying, money, has a corrupting influence. And are efforts made to try and address this problem? Yeah, token efforts are made because people want to see that something is being done. But in practice, it's not effective because it was never designed to be effective. On this encyclopedia of the deep state that I edit, WikiSpooks, it's always interesting to hear what people have to say and what governments have to say, what authorities have to say. But if that conflicts with tangible evidence, if we have people, if we have videos, if we have documents which tell another story, then it's very naive to just assume the government's always telling the truth. Having compiled this episode, I've come to the conclusion that a lot of the problem is in our minds. We don't see the world clearly. We use enemy images. We have ideas about good guys and bad guys. I will be concentrating in this episode to get across the facts of the case as I see them, as unimpeded as I can by enemy images, to try not to get over the message that these are the good guys, these are the bad guys. I am not in a position to make those judgments. And when I'm writing the Encyclopedia of the Deep State, WikiSpooks, I try very hard to let the facts speak for themselves. As a reminder of just how dramatically irrational, fear-based narratives can dominate reasoned conclusions based on evidence, let's turn to Silvio Federici speaking in episode 327.
The witches were the terrorists of the 16th and 17th century. The witch hunt was very analogous in many ways to what the war on terror is today.
I think that's a very disturbing, a very valuable historical parallel. It's easier now, a few centuries on, to look back and say how misguided these people were. And let's try and look at the world objectively. Reject these emotional labels, these terms which carry a big emotional charge but not much in the way of real, actual meaning. In the 21st century, any war is a civil war. The human race is fighting itself, and that's an attitude that I would like to foster. I see another side of the war on terror living in Bangladesh, a Muslim country. People find it's harder for them to get to Britain because of the images that are being used to assault the British population. And I think, as much as we can, let's try and embrace a global perspective. We have the technology now. the internet a wonderful means to try to have a global dialogue, a grassroots discussion, a rethinking of the stories which have seen tremendously destructive wars between people and against the natural environment, which has been itself a kind of enemy image. So let's hear a thought now from Peter Dale Scott, the doyen of deep politics.
The more status someone has in this society, the harder it is for them to listen to suggestions that there is something illegitimate about the power structure in which they have that status. Thus, the paradox that ordinary people are more likely to disbelieve the official theories about 9/11 or JFK than are people with higher education and greater access to information. So my book is addressed to the problem of the ignorance of the highly educated.
Now, if you're a new listener, you may be wondering, who is this guy? Just to give you a bit of background on myself, I am highly educated in the terms of the system. I don't appeal to that as grounds for you to have much faith in what I'm saying. I believe the information that I present should stand on its own merits, but I mention that I have a PhD in case you are predisposed to think, well, that means that what this person is saying should be taken more seriously. I generally don't take that line with other people, but in case that's important to you, I thought I would mention it. I grew up in Europe, and when I finished my PhD, intent to try to make the world a better place, I came here to Bangladesh, where I've been living for the last 20-odd years. This has given me, as you can understand, a hands-on experience of Muslims, and I have found Bangladeshis extremely friendly to foreigners and feel more at ease in this country than I do in Britain nowadays. So I've got very little time for this argument that there's something inherently wrong with the Muslim faith and that these people are inclined to take up arms, even to kill themselves, in the pursuit of some fanatical goal. I do, however, see something wrong with a system predicated on human selfishness. So to introduce that line of thought, let's hear the following short quote from Hannah Arendt.
Totalitarianism is, quote, a never-present danger, grounded in the endless process of capital and power accumulation.
Disturbing though it may be, I think this gives us a more fruitful basis on which to understand what is referred to in the corporate media as the war on terror. Now let's turn to Peter Phillips, a professor of journalism from Sonoma State University's Project Censored, which focuses on the big stories which corporate media refuses to go near.
Especially since 9/11, the policy of the elites have been mostly united in support of American empire military power that maintains a repressive war against resisting groups, typically labeled terrorists, around the world. This war on terror is much more about protecting transnational globalization and capital, dollar hegemony, access to oil, than it is about repressing terrorism or protecting us.
We are going to hear more from Professor Phillips, but the one voice which we're going to hear the most from of any of the speakers in this episode is Canadian social critic Professor John McMurtry. He stated that increasingly spectacular violence was going to be used to try to manipulate people in the West to go along with the agenda of those who were busy instigating the violence. This is a summary from episode 87.
We live under an increasingly global reign of terror, but our disconnection from the meaning is its triumph. Instead, we're made to believe that the terror comes from pre-industrial fanatics in poor countries.
I think it's worth noting that there's been minimal democratic input. Citizens in the West have not been asked about this terrorism question. They've been told, this is what's going on, this is what we're going to do about it. I do remember a stage when bombs were going off in London. This was blamed on the IRA, and people said things like, well, we shouldn't let the terrorists affect our way of life. We should keep living the way we would like to live. And if some crazy people want to set off bombs, we will try and stop them, but we won't abandon habeas corpus. We won't allow people to be locked up without having a fair trial and a public trial. I will be trying to take a bigger picture view, looking at what is going on, how it's represented, why it's misrepresented, and what are the deeper purposes that these events are serving. We're going to hear the whole of John McMurtry's speech from episode 87 in due course, but to let you know where that's going, this is something of a conclusion in which he encapsulates his main point, that this is not a democratic process. He suggests, in effect, that this notion of promoting democracy, like the war on terrorism, is a big lie. It's not about keeping people safe. It's not about empowering underprivileged people. It's about smoothing resistance to a predetermined corporate agenda to turn the natural world into profit, ultimately to control what's going on planet Earth.
The key master lie is this one, that the politically imposed, not economically, the politically imposed global corporate system calling itself the global free market, that that politically imposed global corporate system equals the free market, equals democracy, equals the solution to poverty.
Now we're going to hear more about the connections between corporations and war, but now let's hear a more recent recording. This is from 2018, in the same vein, and picks up on a metaphor introduced by US President Eisenhower.
The military-industrial complex has become the primary resource extraction service for corporate capitalism and is preparing the future generations for its dead-end street of endless war.
As well as the John McMurtry piece, we're also going to hear the whole of an essay read by Lynn Gehry in episode 87. That was entitled Escaping the Matrix, which gave me the structure for this program, the comparison between the deeper purposes of what is organized and the public images, the storylines used to lull the public into its acceptance.
In the latest Matrix reality, the West is called the international community, whose goal is to serve humanitarian causes.
Over the years, many people have asked me, why did I come to Bangladesh? And I've had time to reflect on the road that took me here. And one of the events that keeps coming up is my shock. I had two great shocks as a boy when turning on the television. The first was seeing massive famine in Ethiopia. This was about the time of Live Aid, so it did get publicity, and I saw tremendous hunger and suffering. I was really shocked that that could go on in the modern world, and was asking parents and teachers and people, well, why don't we stop this? What could be more important than preventing that sort of thing happening? And there was a mixture of responses. One of the responses, of course, is, well, you should give some money if you feel that strongly about it. So I can't remember whether I did or not, to be honest, but I do also clearly remember the shock of next year, same thing happens again. It's a repeat performance. Seeing that although the story was, yeah, well, this is a terrible thing and give us some money and we'll stop it happening, that this was business as usual for somebody. Because if we can put a man on the moon, I thought, how can we not move a ship full of food to some hungry people? What is it that's more important? Well, I was shocked by some of the people around me who seemed to think that football or fashion or a bunch of apparently irrelevant stuff in my eyes was nevertheless more important. So that determination to try to make the world a better place, as my mother said, is part of what propelled me to Bangladesh. The awareness, in the words of John Perkins, that
every day, 24,000 people die of starvation,
a powerful
and 30,000 children die of curable diseases every single day.
A threat that needs to be fought by a war on terror.
Shocking statistics illustrates the magnitude.
But much of this threat is a fantasy, which has been exaggerated and distorted by politicians.
Highlights.
It's a dark illusion that has spread unquestioned through governments around the world, the security services, and the international media.
Go about your daily business and pay your taxes to a government which may claim that it's terribly interested in feeding the hungry people of the world, but nevertheless has a track record which would speak otherwise. For more on what is told by corporate media and what is not told, let's hear the following piece from episode 167 back in 2003, entitled Paying for Empire.
It's titled Lessons in How to Lie About Iraq, and the author is musician Brian Eno. He wrote,
to borrow
when
Langdon Winter's
visited
term,
Russia
the direction
in 1986,
of human affairs
I made friends with a musician whose father
of
had been Brezhnev's personal doctor. By
one
which
day we were talking
Winter
about means
life during the
quote, that it appears
period of stagnation,
to be under
the
direction the
Brezhnev
of
era.
Men and women. But if those
it must have been strange being so completely immersed in propaganda,
they go. The system has built in protections
ah,
and someone
there is
else
a difference. We
who
knew
will
it was propaganda,
appear to be directing
Sasha.
The machine is put into play.
That is the difference. Russian propaganda was so obvious that most Russians were able to ignore it. They took it for granted that the government operated in its own interests, and any message coming from it was probably slanted, and they discounted it. In the West, the calculated manipulation of public opinion to serve political and ideological interests is much more covert, and therefore much more effective. Its greatest triumph is that we generally don't
it's
notice it, or laugh at the notion that it even exists. We watch the democratic process taking place, heated debates in which we feel we could have a voice, and think that, because we have a free media, it would be hard for the government to get away with anything very devious without someone calling them on it. It takes something as dramatic as the invasion of Iraq to make us look a bit more closely and ask, how did we get there? How exactly did it come about that, in a world of AIDS, global warming, 30-plus active wars, several famines, cloning, genetic engineering, and 2 billion people in poverty, practically the only thing we all talked about for a year was Iraq and Saddam Hussein. Was it really that big a problem? Or were we somehow manipulated into believing the Iraq issue was important and had to be fixed right now, even though a few months before, few had mentioned it, and nothing had changed in the interim? In the wake of the events of 11 September 2001, it now seems clear that the shock of the attacks was exploited in America. According to Sheldon Rampton and John Stauber in their new book Weapons of Mass Deception, it was used to engineer a state of emergency that would justify an invasion of Iraq. Rampton and Stauber expose how news was fabricated and made to seem real. But they also demonstrate how a coalition of the willing, far-right officials, neocon think tanks, insanely pugilistic media commentators, and of course, well-paid PR companies worked together to pull off a sensational piece of intellectual dishonesty. Theirs is a study of modern propaganda. What occurs to me in reading their book is that the new American approach to social control is so much more sophisticated and pervasive that it really deserves a new name. It isn't just propaganda anymore, it's prop agenda. It's not so much the control of what we think, but the control of what we think about. When our governments want to sell us a course of action, they do it by making sure it's the only thing on the agenda, the only thing everyone's talking about. And they preload the ensuing discussion with highly selected images, devious and prejudicial language, dubious linkages, weak or false intelligence, and selected leaks. What else can the spat between the BBC and Alistair Campbell be but a prime example of this? With the ground thus prepared, governments are happy if you then use the democratic process to agree or disagree. For after all, their intention is to mobilize enough headlines and conversation to make the whole thing seem real and urgent. The more emotional the debate, the better. Emotion creates reality. Reality demands action. An example of this process is one highlighted by Rampton and Stauber, which, more than any other, consolidated public and congressional approval for the 1991 Gulf War. We recall the horrifying stories, incessantly repeated, of babies in Kuwaiti hospitals ripped out of their incubators and left to die while the Iraqis shipped the incubators back to Baghdad. 312 babies, we were told.
673.
They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
The story was brought to public attention by Nayira, a 15-year-old, quote, nurse, who it turned out later was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador in the U.S. and a member of the Kuwaiti royal family. Nayira had been tutored and rehearsed by the Hill and Knowlton PR agency, which in turn received $14 million from the American government for their work in promoting the war. Her story was entirely discredited within weeks, but by then its purpose had been served. It had created an outraged and emotional mindset within America which overwhelmed rational discussion. As we are seeing now, the most recent Gulf War entailed many similar deceits. False linkages made between Saddam, Al-Qaeda, and 9/11, stories of ready-to-launch weapons that didn't exist, of nuclear programs never embarked upon. As Rampton and Stauber show, many of these allegations were discredited as they were being made, not least by this newspaper, that being the Observer Guardian, but nevertheless were retold. Throughout all this, the hired gun PR companies were busy preconditioning the emotional landscape. Their marketing talents were particularly useful in the large-scale manipulation of language that the campaign entailed. The Bushites realized, as do all ideologues, that words create realities, and that the right words can overwhelm any chance of balanced discussion. Guided by the overtly imperial vision of the Project for a New American Century, whose members now form the core of the American administration, the PR companies helped finesse the language to create an atmosphere of simmering panic, where American imperialism would come to seem not only acceptable, but right, obvious, inevitable, and even somehow kind. Aside from the incessant weapons of mass destruction, there were regime change, military invasion, preemptive defense, attacking a country that is not attacking you, critical regions, countries we want to control, and axis of evil, countries we want to attack, shock and awe, massive obliteration, and war on terror, a hold-all excuse for projecting American military force anywhere. Meanwhile, U.S. federal employees and military personnel were told to refer to the invasion as a war of liberation, and to Iraqi paramilitaries as death squads, while the reliably sycophantic American TV networks spoke of Operation Iraqi Freedom, just as the Pentagon asked them to, thus consolidating the supposition that Iraqi freedom was the point of the war. Anyone questioning the invasion was soft on terror, liberal, or, in the case of the UN, in danger of losing its relevance. When I was young, an eccentric uncle decided to teach me how to lie. Not, he explained, because he wanted me to lie, but because he thought I should know how it's done, so I would recognize when I was being lied to. I hope writers such as Rampton and Stauber and others may have the same effect and help to emasculate the culture of spin and dissembling that is overtaking our political establishments. And that was an article, Lessons in How to Lie About Iraq, by Brian Eno, published in the August 17th edition of the London Observer.
Most of the rest of the show is going to be very short excerpts, and some of them edited to highlight the points I'm trying to make, preserve a continuous narrative. There's a lot of background, a lot of context, so if you feel curious about any particular point, I'll encourage you to go to the appropriate page and listen to the full two-hour show. I'm focusing now on Iraq because it is well understood, not only that there was widespread lying by corporate media, but that this was masterminded, Operation Mass Appeal, by the so-called security services. I find that a very misleading label, because whose security are they serving? Surely not the people in Iraq, and surely not the people of the nation whose interests they are purportedly representing. I am going to address the question later on in the show of what they're in fact up to. And that was Brian Eno's outsider's view. For an insider's perspective, let's hear an excerpt from episode 586, The Iron Triangle, which looked at the Carlyle Group and its profiteering from war.
The propaganda campaign waged by the media was so successful that by 2003, opinion polls showed the vast majority of Americans believed Saddam Hussein was linked to 9/11. This claim was false. The majority believed he possessed stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. This claim, too, was false. These claims allowed the corporate interests and the administration to frame the attack on Iraq as a justifiable act of self-defense. Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski worked at the Pentagon. She saw firsthand how the intelligence was distorted to win support for the attack.
The information in there, drawn from fact, you could find bits and pieces of fact throughout, but framed, articulated, crafted to convince someone of what? Well, of things that weren't true. 911, Al-Qaeda related to Saddam Hussein, possibly some involvement there. The very things that a year later, President Bush himself denies and feigns his surprise. I don't know why everybody thinks that.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
Well, I worked in a place where they concentrated on preparing this storyline and selling it.
502.
The words freedom and democracy are often heard as part of the official dialogue to describe what our society is and has and what others lack. The meanings of these words are generally undefined, and their application to what actually happens in this society is considered too outre for mainstream political discourse. The unmentioned elephant in the parlor is that our putative American freedoms accrue to individuals in proportion to their position in an economic hierarchy that dooms most to a life with very little freedom indeed. If freedom means the ability to amply meet one's physical survival needs with dignity so that one may spend one's time and effort in a meaningful and emotionally satisfying way, is our economic system based on employment compatible with a free society?
A very important question there from Lynn Gary, I think. But before we get round to answering that, we're going to hear one more fairly longish piece which hints at what may be going on behind the scenes of concocted rhetoric about bringing freedom and democracy to poor, underprivileged people not yet enjoying the benefits of a free market. This is from episode 76.
Nina Burley has written for the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and New York Magazine. As a reporter for Time, she was among the first American journalists to enter Iraq after the Gulf War. Her article, Missing the Oil Story, was published on TomPaine.com on October 11th. She writes, "Recently I attended one of those legendary Washington dinner parties, attended by British cosmopolites and Americans in the know. A few courses in, people were gossiping about the Bush family's close and enduring friendship with the Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar, Dean of the Diplomatic Corps in Washington. By the end of the evening, everyone was talking about how the unfolding events were going to affect the flow of oil out of Central Asia. I left wondering whether 6,000 Americans might prove to have died in New York for the royal family of Saud, or oil, or both. But I didn't have much more than insider dinner gossip to go on. I get my analysis from the standard all-American news outlets, and they've been too focused on A, anthrax and smallpox, or B, the intricacies of Muslim fanaticism, to throw any reporters at the murky ways in which international oil politics and its big players have a stake in what's unfolding. A quick Nexus search brought up a raft of interesting leads that would keep me busy for 10 years if the economics of this war was my beat. But only two articles in the American media since September 11th have tried to describe how big oil might benefit from a cleanup of terrorists and other anti-American elements in the Central Asia region. One was by James Ridgway of the Village Voice. The other was by a Hearst writer based in Paris, and it was picked up only in the San Francisco Chronicle. In other words, only the left is connecting the dots of what the Russians have called the Great Game, how oil underneath the stands fits into the New World Order. Here's just a small slice of what ought to provoke deeper research by American reporters with resources and talent. Start with Father Bush. The former president and ex-CIA director is not unemployed these days. He's been globetrotting as a member of Washington's Carlyle Group, a $12 billion private equity firm which employs a motorcade of former ranking Republicans, including Frank Carlucci, Jim Baker, and Richard Darman. George Bush Sr. and colleagues open doors overseas for the Carlyle Group's Axis capitalists. Bush specializes in Asia, and has been in and out of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, countries that revere him thanks to the Gulf War, often on business since his presidency. Baker, the pinstripe midwife of Election 2000, was working his network in the stands before the ink was dry on Clinton's first inaugural address. The Bin Laden family, presumably the friendly wing, is also invested in Carlyle. Carlyle's portfolio is heavy in defense and telecommunications firms, although it has other holdings, including food and bottling companies. The Carlyle connection means that George Bush Sr. is on the payroll from private interests that have defense business before the government, while his son is president. As Charles Lewis of the Washington-based Center for Public Integrity has put it, in a really peculiar way, George W. Bush could someday benefit financially from his own administration's decisions through his father's investments, and that, to me, is a jaw-dropper. Why can we assume that global businessmen like Bush Sr. and Jim Baker care about who runs Afghanistan, and not just because it's home base for lethal anti-Americans? Because it also happens to be situated in the middle of that perennial vital national interest, a region abundant with oil. By 2050, Central Asia will account for more than 80% of our oil. On September 10th, an industry publication, Oil and Gas Journal, reported that Central Asia represents one of the world's last great frontiers for geological survey and analysis, offering opportunities for investment in the discovery, production, transportation, and refining of enormous quantities of oil and gas resources. Close quote. It's assumed that we need unimpeded access in the stands for our geologists, construction workers, and pipelines if we are going to realize the conservation-free, fossil-fueled future outlined recently by Vice President Cheney. A number of pipeline projects to carry Central Asia's resources west are already underway or have been proposed. They would go through Russia, through the Caucasus, or via Turkey and Iran. Each route will be within easy reach of the Taliban's thugs and could be made much safer by an American vanquishment of Muslim terrorism. There is also lots of oil beneath the turf of our politically precarious newest best friend, Pakistan. Massive untapped gas reserves are believed to be lying beneath Pakistan's remotest deserts, but they are being held hostage by armed tribal groups demanding a better deal from the central government, reported Agence France-Presse just days before September 11th. So many business deals, so much oil, all those big players with powerful connections to the Bush administration. It doesn't add up to a conspiracy theory, but it does mean there is significant money subtext that the American public ought to know about as Operation Enduring Freedom blasts new holes where pipelines might someday be buried.
We continue with Jeremy Scahill, well known for his expose of the private military contractor with close connections to the Bush family, at that time referred to as Blackwater. I believe it's changed its name a couple of times since. May have something to do with his expose. This is what he had to say from episode 440.
It's actually the corporations that are in control of this country. You know, in many ways, there's already been a coup in the United States, and it sort of defies the electoral process because the electoral process becomes irrelevant to the coup because no one's going to become president who would challenge the coup. There's this scene in the movie Usual Suspects where Kevin Spacey's character says the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. You know, the corporations run everything already. Our lives are being radically privatized in front of us. Every aspect of life is increasingly privatized. Schools, healthcare, education, the military, law enforcement, prisons, everything is being privatized. We have greater control being wielded over others by a smaller and smaller group of people. That, to me, is the premier issue of our lifetime, the dominance of corporations, because it seeps into every part of our life. And it really does cut across the spectrum, too. It's not about being liberal or conservative. I mean, I don't like those labels at all. It's going to impact everyone except that small group of, they're not privileged people. They're people that have stolen from others and refuse to give back. We have an epic battle that is unfolding in this world, and it's not in vogue to talk about it like this. But it's as simple as this. It's once again the haves and the have-nots. And the haves have more than they ever have. And the have-nots are poorer and poorer around the globe.